That was a week, huh? What happened, why, and what it means. Straight ahead from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday, August the 16th. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Yield curves and trade wars and recessions, oh my. You throw in some stock market volatility, a global slowdown. I mean, how much more do you need? People, as I said, it has been a week, so here we go. Samaya Keynes is with The Economist. Lynette Lopez is at Business Insider. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
So, Lynette, let me start with you and this observation from Wednesday. The yield curve inverts, which we talked about on the program. The stock market goes bananas, and everybody says, oh, my goodness, a recession is starting day after tomorrow. We all know that's not true, but here's the question. When a recession comes, because recession is coming at some point, we just don't know when. When it comes, do we have the tools to fight it? Because the Federal Reserve is already cutting. There's not a lot of fiscal space, right? The government can't really spend all that much more money. Are we set? Are we jammed? What are we doing?
I don't think we're ready at all. I mean, look who's running this economy right now. We have people at the top who insist that what's happening is not really happening, that the trade war is not really impacting the American consumer, that they say that they can have it both ways, that the economy is doing well, but that also interest rates need to go down because the economy needs to be juiced a little bit more. So we don't have anybody who's speaking honestly to the American people and who seems to be able to have a grasp on any kind of economics to be able to work through this problem. And we don't have any coalition building politicians in the White House. So,
All right. Well, so Samaya, let me turn it to you then and ask you this. We saw the president this week pull back on half of the big extra set of tariffs that he was going to put on China. Instead of 1 September, they will now go into effect, he says, unless things change, on December the 15th. And he said, as did his Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross, listen, we didn't want to mess with the Christmas shopping season over here. Now, this is a president and an administration, to Lynette's point, which has been saying forever, China's paying the tariffs the American consumers are not paying. So what are we supposed to do with them now acknowledging that American consumers are paying these tariffs?
Oh, well, we could optimistically acknowledge it as a sort of evolution, perhaps, in the president's thinking. Maybe now he's realized that actually, if you impose tariffs very, very quickly, then the burden of the tariffs is going to fall on the importer. And in this case, you know, that they're going to hit lots of consumer goods, and that is much, much more likely to be passed on to the American consumer. So, you know, we could take a glass half full approach to this, and that's hopefully the take. I mean, the negative one would just be that, you know, there was a bit of disingenuousness earlier on.
Lynette, I heard every the sharp time, intake of breath. There we go. I knew
every
it.
Time this president has started to sound reasonable, he backtracks and starts sounding unreasonable again. Perfect example, you know, common sense, you know, gun control. At first, he was like, maybe we shouldn't allow Americans to kill each other, acknowledging that problem. And now it seems he's going to reverse and go back into his old way of thinking. It's going to be the same with tariffs. He's going to quickly forget that he acknowledged that there was a problem for the American consumer. And he's going to keep doing what he's always been doing because he doesn't know how to do anything else.
Samaya, let me turn a little bit to the politics of this situation. And Lynette, I'm going to get you to weigh in here as well. But Samaya, something the president said last night in his rally struck me. That bit, and everybody, I'm sure, has heard this piece of tape where he says, you got to vote for me because otherwise your 401k is going to go all kinds of terrible ways. It is common practice in this country for politicians to say, vote for me, I'm going to make the American economy better. It is rare for, unprecedented perhaps, for an American politician to say, in essence, vote for me or else the economy is going to be terrible. And I want to get the thoughts from both of you on that.
Yeah,
nice
it's
economy
kind of like
there.
Like an economic.
All right.
Yeah. Shame if anything would happen to
Smith,
it.
You go first. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say it's kind of like a kind of hostage situation, which feels like a slightly negative way to play it. I mean, you're I'm not sure that President Donald Trump should have been taking all the credit for the successes. Now he seems to sort of be threatening the American public with things going down if he doesn't get reelected. I mean, there's a risk things go downhill sooner.
Americans don't want to be threatened by the president. We don't want to feel like we're living in one giant economic escape room. And so, you know, I don't think this is going to go over well for people who critically think about the president. But there are a lot of people who simply don't. So I'm sure that'll be fine with them.
Last question, and Lynette, I'll stay with you. And then, Samaya, I'm going to give you the last word. And I know we've gotten really political today on this show about business and economics, but it has played all week this way. The president is walking a fine line between his trade war, Lynette, and what it's doing to the global and American economies, and his hopes for reelection, which even his closest advisors say rests on the American economy. Discuss.
Yeah, I mean, yes. Does he know how to do anything else? No. Is he going to continue doing this? Yes. I don't think there's no brake pedal. There's no plan B. He wants to watch China squirm. The Chinese economy is slowing down with more pressure from the U.S., but you can't have the number one and number two economy slowing down and the rest of the world starting to look very scary and not have a global recession on your hands.
Samaya Keynes, last word to you.
Yeah, so it's possible that we're okay. I just want to, you know, maybe I'm a glass half full person.
Look, we have to say the American
economy. Okay, yay. So
here's the deal, though. We have to say the American economy right now is strong, right?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the hard data, things haven't been looking that bad, right? The American consumer is chugging along. It's doing okay. Right. Sentiment is not good, right? And that's the biggest risk. And I think actually the president has identified that, right? He's been accusing people of talking things down. I think he's understating his own responsibility for that decline in sentiment. And I think if he were really playing a sensible strategic electoral strategy, he would be changing his behavior to try and actually to change that uncertainty that's there.
Right, to run on the economy. Samaya Keynes at The Economist and Lynette Lopez at Business Insider. Thanks, you two, on a Friday.
Thank you, Kai.
All right, have a nice weekend. Wall Street on this Friday. Remember that deep breath I told you to take back on Wednesday, I guess it was? Not today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. John Deere, the agricultural equipment maker, reported earnings today, and to the surprise of absolutely nobody who's been paying attention to the current state of global trade, Deere missed expectations and said it's adjusting its outlook for the rest of the year downward. In particular, the company said farmers hit by tariffs and retaliatory tariffs, also a ton of bad weather this spring, just aren't all that keen on making big investments right now. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams is on the farm beat today.
Farmers have been feeling the brunt of the U.S.-China trade war. China is blocking some agricultural products and imposing higher taxes on others. Farm costs are rising with tariffs on aluminum and steel. Michael Nevue is an economist at the American Farm Bureau Federation.
It's going to be a difficult decision to try and look to invest $1 million in a new piece of equipment if you're not even sure if you're going to make a profit this year or next year or the year after that.
That uncertainty is showing up in declining business investment across the board. But with many farms still family-run, that risk looks even scarier. Monty Peterson is a fourth-generation farmer growing corn and soybeans in North Dakota. He also works with the U.S. Soybean Export Council.
When we see the uncertainty of revenues, we tend to tighten our belts, pull back on the reins a little bit, reassess, you know, our investment back into our operations.
That means more farmers holding back on big purchases from companies like John Deere. Lindsay Greiner is head of the Iowa Soybean Association. He farms corn, soybeans, and pigs in southeast Iowa.
We're running our combines probably 6 years old. We'd normally be looking at trading it right now, and we have no plans to do that.
Instead, he says, if he needs equipment, he'll try to find something in good shape and used. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
There are some housing numbers out this morning that generated a little bit of buzz. Housing starts were down in July for the third straight month. Nothing to panic about. Starts tend to bounce around a lot. They get revised a lot, too. But as so often happens, you dig into the fine print a bit and you get some wisdom. The decline was in multifamily housing. Single-family construction was actually up a hair. So Marketplace's Eric Barris did a survey of what the other stuff going on in this economy, interest rates and tariffs and labor costs, what that might be doing to new home construction.
Building a single family home is less risky for a developer. They build a house, somebody comes and buys it. But multifamily homes tend to be a riskier proposition, says George Vertu, an economist with Realtor.com.
So that market tends to be a little more volatile.
Building a multifamily unit requires more labor, and labor is expensive right now. It also requires everything from steel and lumber to countertops and appliances. All of those are subject to tariffs, says Daryl Fairweather, chief economist at Redfin.
Anytime there's a burden like tariff, all the other burdens become even more impactful.
Multifamily units could be profitable in densely populated areas, but that's where building costs for those are highest, says Robert Dietz with the National Association of Home Builders.
About a third of a typical apartment building's development cost, which includes the lot development process, that about a third of it is due to regulatory burdens.
The entire housing market is also facing uncertainty. Consumers are spending money, but when it comes to big ticket items, they're holding back. And so are developers, says Lawrence Ales, who teaches economics at Carnegie Mellon University.
We see this not only for housing, but we see it also for other categories of durables and also for business investments.
Alice and others say don't read too much into these most recent numbers. Despite three straight down months, new housing starts are actually up over July of last year. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
Consider Netflix. For a very long time, the 800-pound gorilla of the streaming video market. Now, however, maybe not so much. Last month, the company reported its first U.S. subscriber loss in more than 8 years. And oh, by the way, competition, hello? Natalie Jarvie wrote about what the future might hold for Netflix for The Hollywood Reporter. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
So to quote Fareed Zakaria for perhaps the first and last time on this program, the Geopolitical Observer, this is more the rise of the rest, right, than it's actually Netflix floundering. Everybody else is getting into this game that Netflix has dominated for a very long time.
That's exactly right. I mean, for the last 5 years, 6 years, ever since they launched House of Cards, Netflix has really been the only game in town. Sure, there's Hulu, there's Amazon, but those businesses are a little bit different. And so Netflix has kind of had their run of talent and projects. And now all of a sudden, Disney, Warner Media, Apple, NBC Universal, they're all getting in the game.
Netflix's game, so to speak, has been to just throw money around. That is, however, finite, right?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, at some point, Netflix is going to have to start looking at the amount of cash that they're burning every year and say, we need to start tightening the ship a little bit. But the question for them is that if they have to keep churning out the hits, right, they're going to have to keep spending money. So there is this question of, can they start to pull back on their spend if they need to kind of double down in order to compete with these new platforms that
right,
are coming out?
In an environment where not only are there those new platforms, but there is apparently insatiable demand, right? I mean, we've heard about peak TV and you know, all of that stuff, but consumers just want.
Absolutely. I mean, part of the challenge for Netflix is that they've released Stranger Things. People can binge it in a weekend.
Right. And now what do you got, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Now it doesn't come back for another year and a half.
Right.
So they've got to constantly be coming up with the next show that's going to get people hooked. And that's a hard business to stay in.
So let's talk about some of the competition. Disney first. Huge, ginormous back catalog, you know, Avengers and all of that stuff that they can roll out. Biggest threat, do you think?
Disney has the most well-known brand of all of these media companies mm-hmm. that are launching their streaming services. Not to mention, Disney has been adamant about pricing this service very
yeah,
attractively,
no joke.
So that you know, it'll be considerably cheaper than Netflix.
Apple.
Apple's the big question. They have had all these flashy announcements over the last, you know, year.
Right.
Steven Spielberg, Oprah, J.J. Abrams, right. Reese Witherspoon
in that morning show thing.
Jennifer Aniston.
Right.
But we don't actually know a whole lot. There are some big question marks there. Now it's Apple, and they can definitely throw money at this service, but right. It kind of remains to be seen what that service will be.
What do you think the consumer's load is for piling on all of these subscription services? Because you add them up and eventually you're paying what you used to pay for cable.
Most of the smart people that I talk to who observe this space mm-hmm. don't think that people are going to suddenly start canceling Netflix because of Disney Plus. But one thing that could be really interesting is how much consumers start to kind of come in and out of mm-hmm. these services. Mm-hmm. Maybe you sign up for Netflix when The Crown is all on in the fall right. and then, you know, you cancel it and then you go to Disney Plus for The Mandalorian. And right. that could be kind of an interesting trend.
Natalie Jarvie, she's the digital media editor at The Hollywood Reporter. Natalie, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up.
I was like, oh my gosh, yes, I look so bomb.
That is some confidence right there, headed back to that first day of school, huh? First, though, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 306 today, 1.2%, 25,886. The NASDAQ jumped 129 points, 1.6%, 78-95. The S&P 500 rose 41 points, 1.4%, ended at 2888. Maybe on a different week it would have been the really happy music for that. I don't know. Major indices finished the week, as I was alluding to, in negative territory. The Dow off 1.5%, NASDAQ down 0.7%, the S&P 500 off 1%. General Electric bounced back today after that short seller report yesterday, picked up 9.7%, did GE. The company's CEO moved to shore up confidence by buying nearly $2 million worth of the company's stock on his own account. Banks rose as bond yields pulled back from those historic lows. We talked about Citigroup, up 3.5%. Yield on the 10-year Treasury, by the way, let me sneak this in, up to 1.56%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey, it's Molly Wood here, and I want you to listen to the latest Make Me Smart. This week, we're talking privacy. There's a lot of doublespeak when it comes to that term. There's the pivot to privacy that Facebook announced. Apple loves to say that what happens on your iPhone stays on your iPhone. But your idea of privacy is probably a lot different.
I like to think of the context where you're sitting in a bar, having a drink after work with a coworker, and you're talking about your boss. You might not say to your coworker, hey, by the way, all of this information is private. Please don't share it with the boss. But you have that expectation nonetheless. Then if you take that into the digital context, now I think that companies are kind of sucking up this information, and they might not necessarily be as sensitive to our expectations about how that information is going to be used as your coworker might in a bar.
Hint, tech companies are not your coworker buddy. Make Me Smart. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. When you go get a cup of coffee, your local purveyor may well be one of the thousands now offering oat milk alongside soy and almond and cow. Oat milk's at Target and Whole Foods, regular old supermarkets as well. It is mainstream, basically. The Swedish company Oatly dominates the oat milk market. They kind of started the whole thing, in point of fact. Dina Shanker wrote about Oatly and that oat milk market for Bloomberg. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
So is oat milk like milk milk? I mean, is that basically what it is when it pours out of the jug or whatever?
Oat milk tastes a lot like milk milk. It's creamy. It's not as sweet as almond milk and soy milk. And it has a very similar mouthfeel to milk milk. And the reason it got so popular is that baristas loved how much it foamed like milk milk.
Oh, that's too funny. That's too funny. And then this company, Oatly, right, somehow now basically has the market. Where did it come from?
So Oatly is this Swedish company that arrived in the U.S. a couple of years ago. Oatly has become a huge trend on its own as an oat milk maker. Even though there are other oat milks out there, Oatly is really the brand to get. Anything else is sort of a backup brand.
Of course, the biggies in the beverage world have looked at Oatly and said, we want a piece of that, right? I mean, Pepsi's in this now. There's got to be.
Oh, yeah. Pepsi has an oat beverage. They don't call it a milk, playing it extra careful there. And then there's other plant-based companies that have gotten in there, too. Califia Farms is a good example. They have a full range of plant-based dairy alternative products, and now that range includes oat milk.
Is it healthier than bovine milk, or is that not a consideration?
I would say that's a loaded question, and it really depends on who you ask. But the big draw, I think, is the environmental impact that Oatly has compared to dairy. That environmental impact is a major reason why people are cutting back on their meat and their dairy products. And of course, that doesn't even include things like animal welfare or the impact of manure on water quality and all sorts of other issues that a socially conscious consumer might consider when making their choices.
Have you had it? I mean, personally,
I have had it. I really like it. It's, and I drink milk. But sometimes I'm I'm at a coffee shop, I'll ask if they have oat milk. Although I'm not as particular as to ask for Oatly, although I might be now that I've done this story. But I really like it. And I think it's nice, to have the option, and to occasionally, cut down my own dairy consumption for environmental reasons.
Dina Shanker, she covers food at Bloomberg. Dina, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
If you're a kid, or you know one, or you have one, this can be a stressful time. School has either just started or is starting soon. Back to getting up early, studying and tests, homework, extracurriculars, also social pressure to fit in, make a good impression, especially that first day. Social media hasn't made any of that any easier, but as Marketplace's Marielle Segarra reports, there is money in trying.
Hannah Mowdy was so ready for her first day of sixth grade. She was going to a new school with new kids, and she'd gone shopping for the perfect outfit.
I was wearing a black t-shirt. It had a peace sign on the front. It was like rainbow, but like the peace sign was made out of zippers.
Zippers. She also wore long jean shorts and sparkly black Converse.
I was like, oh my gosh, yes, I look so bomb.
And then she got to school, and the other girls were wearing short shorts and sneakers and t-shirts with logos she'd never seen before. Hollister, Abercrombie.
And I'm like, where did I go so wrong? I feel like I stuck out like a sore thumb.
Hannah's in college now, and she will never get that day back. But there's a legion of young YouTube influencers who've turned preventing future Hannahs into a back-to-school business opportunity with videos like these.
Hey, guys!
What's going on, guys?
Hey, guys, what's up?
We are going to be going to school shopping!
These are pastel highlighters. I'm definitely getting these.
Okay, so here's outfit number one, and I love this outfit so much.
There are a lot of these videos online, and they are popular. 17-year-old Sadie Aldis, who's a senior in high school, has been making back-to-school videos for 3 years. Her latest has almost 500,000 views and more than 1,500 comments.
They are one of my best-performing videos, actually. I'm pretty sure it's because it's such a relatable thing to my audience.
The start of a new school year is a huge moment in a kid's life, full of possibility. Your erasers are clean. Your notebooks, crisp.
It's the best thing to know that you have all of this cute supplies and you're walking into school not with the same notebook that you've been using for 5 years.
But along with all the excitement, there can be a ton of pressure to fit in, especially on your first day. 10-year-old YouTube influencer Eliana lives in Florida, and the back-to-school fashion videos she makes with her older sister, Emma Marie, get hundreds of thousands of views.
Probably because, like, a lot of people, like me and Emma's age, like, want to see what people wear to school so they know what's, like, popular to wear, I guess.
Her sister Emma, who's 15, wears a lot of crop tops with ripped jeans and Vans. Her YouTube channel has more than 1 million subscribers.
Whatever I'm wearing that they really like, they want to go get, and they want to know where to get it from.
Just so happens they can get it from her. Emma has her own line, including shirts, a hoodie, and a puka shell necklace. Apparently those are in again. Kids can make thousands of dollars with fashion and school supply videos. Some have corporate sponsors like JCPenney and Target. Kids also collect when marketers advertise next to their content. Even notebooks need influencers now. Jessica Hodges is VP of Marketing at ACCO Brands. It owns Mead, maker of spiral notebooks and folders.
We live and die by back to school.
And Hodges says these days, the company is thinking about marketing differently.
Gen Z, this current generation of kids, they listen to their peer group more than they listen to brands marketing directly to them.
So ACCO has started sponsoring some of these persuasive kids and giving them free products to review. As for Hannah Mowdy, the one with the zipper peace sign t-shirt, she's 20 now and has become a YouTube influencer herself. She goes by Hannah Elise. Her latest back-to-school video got more than 800,000 views, and she has just about recovered from that experience in sixth grade. I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, we've been talking a lot about the bond market this week, the yield curve, the inversion thereof, what the functional difference is between, say, a one-month Treasury bill and a 30-year bond. Hopefully you've got all that straight, because from Bloomberg this afternoon, this item, the Treasury Department's going to go out and do a little market research about whether there's investor appetite for ultra-long bonds, 50- and 100-year maturities. Two things about that. First of all, Treasury did this same kind of research a couple of years ago, so there's that. But also, future inflation, which is going to figure into the yields that those bonds are going to have to pay, is basically unknowable. Present-day inflation and interest rates, oh, so very low. So what's the upside on a 50- or 100-year bond anyway? All right, we got to go. Dow Industrials up 306 today, 1.2%. The NASDAQ up 129 points, 1.6%. S&P 500 up 41 points, 1.4%. Lousy week, though, as we all know. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you again on Monday. Everybody, have yourselves a good weekend, all right? This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.